And welcome to The Shift, the official podcast of Beyond the Box Score. I'm your host, Brian Grossnick, and joining me today is the managing editor of Beyond the Box Score. That's probably the first time I've ever said that out loud. It's not me. It's actually our co-managing editor at Beyond the Box Score. It's Neil Weinberg. Neil, how's it going, man?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you enjoying the reins running Beyond the Box Score with Kevin?
Oh, you know, it's been good. I mean, you left us, you know, in pretty good shape, so it hasn't been a very difficult transition, but it's really just a nice thing to just add one more line to the resume. I think that's the number one thing right now. And also the ability now to hire myself to be, you know, the manager in the clubhouse is a nice little addition there, too.
That's nice. That's nice. You can really go the full Dan Jennings on us.
Exactly.
I like that. Yeah, it was. It's really. I bet the transition was moderately easy for you, in part because our staff is excellent. We've always had a really good staff and a lot of really good people, and the editors tend to do a lot of work. And so I just think the site's been great since you and Kevin have taken over. It's much better than when I was running it. So I'm very, very happy with how everything seems to have worked out. And let's not forget, you're not just at Beyond the Box Score. We'll let everybody know. Your resume, like you said, is probably at least two pages now. You're the site educator at Fangraphs. You contribute to the Hardball Times, probably six or seven other outlets at this point. What are the other ones? I think you still do some stuff for Ticetown, and of course you've got New English D, right?
Yeah, that covers about all the things I'm active at, I think. You got them all.
Cool. Well, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the Tigers today. It's a weird team this year. The American League Central is really, really competitive, maybe even more so than we might have expected coming into the year, if for no other reason than the Twins are actually not the worst team in the American League, which is mystifying to me. I have no idea how that happened. Do you want to talk a little bit real quickly about how the season's been going for you as a Tigers fan and as an analyst trying to cover the team?
Sure, yeah. So I think the interesting thing about the Tigers is how they started relative to the expectations and then how they've played the last maybe month of the season. It's been a very interesting ride. I think going into the season, there was a good amount of optimism from the fan base, and I think I was a little behind them and saying, you know, listen, guys, hold on. This team isn't quite as good as you think they are. I mean, you know, four straight division titles. It's a good team. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they were worse off, I think, going into this year than they were a team last year. You know, and that's not even including how poor Victor Martinez was and how, you know, he's going to be gone for however many months it's going to be. All those kind of things that sort of factor in. And then they got off to, like, this incredible start. And you get to the point where it's like, okay, even if they're not a great team anymore, they've won 11 of their first 13 games. And that's usually good enough for an average team to make the playoffs. And so it was kind of like, it was hard to, you know, keep, you know, my foot on the brake for everybody else, and they sort of went off. And then as they sort of came back to the pack, and they're still, you know, have a good record right now. They have a 575 or 574 winning percentage. That's a good record so far. And everybody's kind of still, you know, panicking, like, oh, they haven't played as well. This is the kind of performance you are going to get from the Tigers. They have a lot of great players, but they also have some holes on the roster. They have some problems with the team. They're going to go through these ebbs and flows, especially they've got, you know, you get on base a lot, but then they have a bunch of guys who are slow. So they're like leading the league in double plays by like a million. I think that, you know, if you want to play the on pace game, I think they're on pace to set the record for most double plays, which is kind of an incredible thing to think about given the offensive era we're in. Like, you would imagine that would have happened, you know, when there were runners on base constantly. But it's been an up and down ride. You know, it's a team that I would say, you know, from today, I would still expect this is the team that's going to win the division over the other two. We can talk about the other teams a little bit also. But, you know, up and down ride, there are places they need to improve. A healthy Verlander would really help. Getting Victor Martinez back healthy would help. But, you know, they've kind of been what I expected, but they've done it in such a way that everyone is really kind of on edge about it, I think.
Well, I think that makes some sense because some of the performances by a couple of players on the team in specific have been really out of character,
yes.
I would say. You've got Anibal Sanchez, who has been not what you normally would expect from Anibal Sanchez at all. Right. Alex Avila, you almost take him for granted how steady and solid he's been over the last few years. He went down. Now you've got James McCann. You know, he's playing awfully well, but you know, you would have liked to have been able to maybe shift some folks around. If you were going to lose, say, Martinez for an extended period, you might have been able to, you know, float one of these guys into a DH spot when, but now you don't have Avila either. It's just been really kind of an odd start to the season, I feel like, for the Tigers, because you have some guys who are pretty reliable, and I don't think anybody expected Victor Martinez to play 150 games this season. I mean, he's just got too much of an injury issue, but there's some guys that you were really counting on to hold down the fort, I feel like, who you either are missing time due to injury or like Sanchez are having this like really crazy performance.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the Sanchez one is probably the strangest. You know, it's not hard to explain. Anthony Ghost, you know, I think I wrote an article a week or two ago. You know, it's all BABIP. When the BABIP comes back, you know, he looks, this is what Anthony Ghost is probably going to look like. Jose Iglesias, you know, guy who's got some, you know, ability to get on base and things like that. You know, a little bit, you know, out of character, maybe a little bit, but not too much. The one that's so strange, you know, as far as the guys who are on the field is Sanchez, especially because if you watch him, and, you know, people and Tigers fans who are listening will probably attest to this, everything is fine except he gives up, like, two home runs a game. And it's not like, it's not a matter of, oh, you know, he's getting hit around a lot. He's really just giving up two home runs a game. He just throws a bad pitch, and it's a really strange thing. You know, he had a really rough go of it over two starts back in April, and I sort of looked at it, and I did some GIFs and everything like that, and it was basically just like, yep, they called for a low and away slider, and he hung it, and the guy crushed it, and then he struck out five batters. It was just like, out of nowhere, go for ball. Out of nowhere, go for ball. And he kind of did that again over his last couple of starts. The strikeout rate's good, the walk rate's good, it's not a high BABIP, it's just like this enormous home run rate that you can't really figure out. You know, it's one of those things where, like, it's not, you don't want to, like, look at it and say, oh, his xFIP is fine, so he's going to be fine, because, like, he did throw those terrible pitches, but it's a really good indication of how out of, they just come out of nowhere. He just has an inning where he just gives up, like, two home runs, gives up a huge double, and then he's fine, which is such a strange problem to analyze. There was this thing going on after his first or second bad start where people are like, oh man, like, he's never pitched to James McCann, like, maybe they're not on the same page. And my reaction was like, yeah, because I'm sure James McCann said, here, throw a terrible pitch on this, you know, to Pedro Alvarez. It was really strange, and then, you know, now he's pitched a Holiday a couple times, and it's been the same thing. So that's the one that you kind of got to figure out for the team to be get back on track. Everybody else, you know, it's an easy thing to explain if they're performing out of the ordinary.
Yeah, and I think there have been some pleasant surprises as well. I mean, no doubt, I don't think anybody coming into the season was like, oh yeah, the Tigers bullpen, that's going to be a strength to start the season. No problems there at all. You got one of the top 10 bullpens in baseball, which is, you know, the complete opposite of the last 5 to 10 years, it feels like. And then you've got some positive things. I mean, Ghost started off really hot. You have JD Martinez, who doesn't really look like he's regressing beyond, you know, his 2014 performance too poorly. You know, there's some positive things to look forward to as the season goes on. And maybe, I don't know, possibly the most positive is that there's no chance the Twins are going to play this well for the rest of the season, right? I mean, that's just completely bananas.
So there's two ways to answer this question. The first being, of course not. I mean, you know, there's really, I think, no one who thinks, you know, Joe Mauer's mother doesn't think the Twins are a 600 winning percentage team.
Right.
So obviously, you know, they'll come back to the pack, and that's, you know, not, you know, really up for debate. But the thing about this that's going to drive me crazy all year is, so I think about mid-March, I put together this piece for FanGraphs explaining why the Twins were actually the Padres. In that, basically, it's a relatively similar roster, and that they're exactly the same. They need a little bit to go right, and they'll be really good. And Dave Cameron at Fangraphs read it and said, "Oh, I don't really know if you really sold this. I don't know if, you know, give it another look." I'm like, okay. So I go back and I sort of clean it up a little bit, try and make it clear that, like, my comparison is like, look, they have some of these really similar players. There are similar things about this roster. And he said, can you give it another look? He's like, I don't really like the way you wrote this. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe I'm not making my point very well. And so I'm like, I'm going to write about something else for tomorrow. And now, after the Tigers crushed in the first week, I'm like, okay, good thing I didn't write that. And all the Twins have done since is win. And so now, and like, who would believe me that I said, you know, I'm sure Dave would vouch for me, but I really said, you know, this is exactly the team everyone thinks the Padres are. If you look at the past, like, because the Padres' whole thing was like, these are guys who have this really good name recognition. They're like, their career track record has been good enough that if you're not into quote unquote projections, this is the team. This is a team that you would like. And the Twins were kind of like that. Like, if you buy Mauer and Hunter and these guys, and you say these guys aren't going to age. You're going to get the exact same season from the guys who have overperformed. The Twins are going to be good. And somehow that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, I'm sure the Torii Hunter thing doesn't needle at Tigers fans at all. Right. The fact that there's no good reason why he should be playing well, and yet, you know, he's holding it down for the team at least a little bit. So the Twins are going to regress a little bit. I think that anybody who's watched them play, who's followed the numbers, is pretty sure they're going to regress. And then there are the Royals. And it's really easy to say at the beginning of the season, the Royals are going to regress. And then they've just had some outstanding performances by some guys, Lorenzo Cain. They've really played very well. They've obviously taken over the All-Star balloting. I don't think anybody is going to make the All-Star team unless they're Royal. What do you think about this team? Is this going to be a neck and neck thing? You think they're going to be fighting for the top spot in the Central and probably the wild card, or do you think they'll come back to the pack a little bit more than they've shown thus far?
Yeah, I mean, I think going into the season, I think there was kind of the stat head opinion. You know, the Royals was a little bit, they were kind of like a little bit under 500-ish team. And I think that probably sold them short because, you know, one of those things that we're not always good at predicting is really figuring out which one of the young players are going to sort of take that step forward. You know, on average, the projection is sort of always going to be right about those players.
Right.
But, you know, players legitimately do improve and, you know, get better based on, you know, things that they're working on. And to have Moustakas and Hosmer both seemingly do that at the same time is just a really big boon for this team. You know, again, I don't think Moustakas and Hosmer are going to hit the way they've hit so far all year, but I do think that they are showing signs of, you know, kind of these legitimate steps forward that we've been kind of looking for a while. Particularly Moustakas, there's a really big difference in the way he is sort of approaching hitting this year.
Yeah,
and so that's kind of a big factor that sort of elevates them up a couple of wins over the course of a season. They have a tremendous defense. That's a really valuable thing. The bullpen's very good. This was always going to be like kind of like a borderline wild card team for me, and I think they've shown enough to suggest that they are right in there with the Tigers now, I think.
Yeah, I think they're playing really well. I'm definitely one of those guys who at the beginning of the season was like, nope, you know, they're probably going to be right around 500. Based on true talent level. So if they get the breaks, they're going to be in the wild card contention. If they get breaks the other way, they're going to be, you know, very, very disappointing for everyone who was excited about them last year. And, you know, I tell you, Moustakas is the most confusing to me. I mean, I cannot believe the guy that's walking like 4% of his plate appearances is also managing to be like 50% better than league average offensively. It's just, it's unbelievable what he's doing to reach base despite not, you know, changing his approach in terms of his walk rate really at all. And he's hitting for a little more power. I think he hit another home run today. So, I mean, you know, what are you supposed to do about that? And then the Sox, the White Sox were supposed to be like the big sexy team of the AL in this offseason. And I don't know. I think that whole situation is, you know, Chris Sale is great. Jose Abreu's pretty great, but this team doesn't really look like a contender at this point. Do you think they might go the other way? They might improve as the season goes on and you might see them be a little bit more competitive?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to happen. I think that I think people were too high on the White Sox, but I think the White Sox made some really good moves in the offseason. And I think we have this really long history, as you know, people who watch the game were attracted to the movement. And I think the White Sox improved their roster coming out of the offseason more than most teams did. The problem was they were starting from such a bad place that, like, it's so hard to overcome where they were going into the offseason. The fact that Melky Cabrera, Adam Eaton, and Alexei Ramirez are not hit, like, their combined production is, like, you know, not quite a Brendan Ryan level offense, but not that far off from that. And they're not really making up for it in sort of the other facets of the game. Those guys are going to get better. Those guys are much better hitters than they've been so far. You know, they're getting production from Jose Abreu, and you know, obviously Garcia has performed well, at least to this point. Not quite sold on that. You know, this is a kind of average-ish team, I think, who's played a little below it. They've got really good pitching, starting pitching at the top end. You know, their back end is a little off. They're going to play better. They're not going to play themselves into contention. You know, they were a borderline case going in, and they're like 8 games out already.
Yeah, and I think that you know, they and the Indians both, they were kind of expected to do a little bit better than they've shown thus far in the season. But you know, neither of them are exactly disasters. You know, and we are only right. You know, 40 to 50 games into the season. The Indians are a little bit more surprising, but they seem like they're kind of like the inverse of the Royals in some ways, where they've got just this terrible defense. Their bullpen has been completely untenable. You know, Cody Allen's, you know, really trying hard to lose his job, and they've got kind of all the little things there that the Royals seem to do right is exactly what the Indians do wrong, and vice versa. They walk all the time. They've got a couple of really high end hitters, and yet the Indians seem to be doing relatively poorly compared to what I think projection systems and what the folks thought they might do this season. So are you ready to admit that sabermetrics are over and that we can completely go away from this, or is it just dumb luck?
No, definitely. I mean, I think this is the end. The Indians and the Royals 2015 is kind of the end of the Moneyball era.
Right.
No, but I mean, in reality, I think the Indians are a good – the Indians and the Royals, I think, are a really – maybe the Indians and the Twins more so – are a good test case of how quick you are to respond to new information. So, like, the Twins – if you think the Twins are this good, you know, I would have liked to have heard you say that 5 weeks ago.
Right.
If you think the Indians are this bad, I would have liked to hear that 5 weeks ago. You know, I think it's totally reasonable, some people going into the season saying the Indians aren't going to be that good. There were those people who were kind of like the post, like, hype, anti, whatever that was, the pushback against the Indians love. I think that existed, and I think those people have a right to say, you know, hey, look, you know, there are some flaws on this team. The defense is horrible. I guess my expectation of that going into this year was like, how could it not get better from last year, and that it seems to have gotten worse? And so that, you know, that's, I think that's going to drag them down a little bit. But you know, this is a team that, you know, 46 games ago, we thought this was probably the best team in the division, maybe the second best, whatever. You know, they haven't played up to their potential, but they haven't played that far off their potential. They have, you know, Corey Kluber and Carrasco and Bauer. There's a lot of talent. You know, they have, you know, Santana and Kipnis is playing really well. If you told me before the season that, you know, Jason Kipnis was going to have like an MVP first 2 months, I would have expected the Indians to kind of be running away with things. I think they're going to be fine, and I think they're in a good position to, you know, kind of pick and choose ways to upgrade the roster. They're going to be the kind of team that can add a couple of, like, average relievers and a defensive replacement and, like, get so much better because they're, like, there's this, you know, this bottom of their roster that's causing them some problems. I think they can definitely get back into this thing. I would not write off anyone in the division except the White Sox at this point. And, you know, the Twins I wouldn't consider actual contenders, but they've played so well so far that they're kind of, like, in it by default.
Yeah, and I kind of worry with the wins that the Twins have banked. Like, will they be aggressive? I mean, they've got a great farm system. Could they be aggressive, moving towards the trade deadline and trying to pick up some of these guys from teams like the Brewers, who, are obviously going to have a great big fire sale, and could they improve a lot by adding some big pieces? I'm still not sure. I wouldn't go out on that limb and say that they would do that, but I guess it's a possibility that they could continue to be competitive, and if they continue to be competitive and improve the roster, that'll just make things harder for the rest of the division, even if they don't win it themselves or something like that.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be an interesting thing because they're going to get Ovin Santana back, at the All-Star break or whatever, who's not great, but he's a guy to fill in. They have some young players in the farm system who could maybe contribute in a certain capacity going forward. It's the kind of team, and I think I said this in the article that never got published, that like if they made a couple little moves, like you would kind of think of this as a kind of a contender. There's no reason they couldn't go out and do that, and especially, they pick up a guy, if they could pick up like a Carlos Gomez, get him back after the journey he's been on, that would be, a really interesting addition to that team. They find themselves out there, they grab a reasonably good starting pitcher. It's one of those things, like it's the American League is not, top heavy. They could easily slide in if they do a couple of things right. That's the benefit of winning 28 of your first, whatever, 46 games, is that, you don't have to win those games in the future, and so even a team that's kind of okay is right in it.
Yeah, the thing that's going to be crazy, I think, is that we're going to get into June and July, and I'm not sure any team in the American League is really going to feel like they're out of it until we get really late into the trade deadline season. I mean, it's just such a flat league right now. I think there's a lot of teams that feel like they're competitive. I think the teams that are at the tops of divisions, like maybe the Twins or the Astros, are going to feel like they can be competitive, but at the same time, I think a lot of their competition is going to feel like we can catch these guys. They're just the Astros. Things are okay. So that'll be real interesting to see. And on the other end of the spectrum, kind of, is the National League, where it's, pretty much chalk at this point. I think the dominant teams are playing up to their standards, and they're going to be fine. So it may be some cross-league movement that you'll see. Maybe some of these AL teams are going to have to pick off guys from the National League rather than giving up on themselves.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely the case. I'm looking at that, looking at the National League. I think only the Marlins are out of the divisional ranking spot that I put all of the National League teams in going into the season. And the AL is this like giant jumbled mess of teams that all have between like 21 and 28 wins, is 13 of the teams or something like that. I think the psychology of it is interesting, because if you are, so imagine that instead of the Astros having a 6.5-game lead, if it was the Angels or the Mariners, like, don't you give up if you're the other AL West teams?
Oh,
But
sure.
if it's but it's the Astros, so you're like, no, we could catch them. Even though, like, it's not, fundamentally a huge difference in terms of, the Rangers are 7 games out. It
Right.
doesn't really matter that they're 7 games out from who they're 7 games out of. They're not a different team. But they think, hey, we're kind of still in this. But if, like, oh, we're 7.5 games behind a team that we thought was going to be good, we are maybe not going to chase them in the same way. So it could be interesting to see, especially with the second wild card, like, none of the AL teams sell except for, like, the White Sox. And then all of the NL teams except for, like, five of them sell. And it could be, like you said, a cross-league kind of movement. It's very strange. Like, I think that this is sometimes how the NBA works. I'm not really familiar with that league. But there's been some top-heavy teams in places. Like, nobody's, like, the Nationals and the Cardinals and the Dodgers, like, they're going to win their divisions. Like, maybe somebody really important gets hurt and it doesn't happen. But the AL, like, I don't know that I would bet virtually any substantial amount of money on any team to make the playoffs at this point.
Yeah, I think that's probably a safe bet. And it's funny you mentioned, like, in the National League, maybe if somebody really important gets hurt, maybe the Cardinals, the Nationals, or the Dodgers won't win their division. Well, the Cardinals lost Wainwright, the Dodgers lost Puig, and the Nationals lost Rendon, and, like, they're fine. Like, it would cause, like, multiple
Well, they got to
injuries.
lose somebody else. Like, they had that 5 or 6 game cushion. Now that, you lose, maybe you lose Greinke and it's a problem, or you lose, one of those other guys like that. But yeah,
Yeah,
it's a it's a very different experience watching baseball in the American League and the National League this year.
Well, let's talk a little bit about one of those teams in the National League. We gave you a little bit of props for your preseason prediction that the Twins were maybe a little bit more competitive than people thought. Before the season started, I did a lot of work on the Marlins, and I predicted that the Marlins would not be as good as what people were kind of projecting. They were like, oh, we got D. Gordon, we got Dan Heron, we signed Giancarlo Stanton. Things are going to be great. We're going to be a real competitive team in that second to third spot in the National League East. And I kind of was like, well, maybe we should pump the brakes. I think they're still below 500 team because they've got some issues with depth. What I could not predict was that the Marlins would continue to make really bizarre decisions. And I don't know, maybe I should have, maybe we should have thought more that this was a possibility, but they went ahead and they fired their manager, Mike Redman, who will now probably go to the Twins and be on the staff there. And they replaced him with general manager Dan Jennings. It's been all over the news. And so we have a general manager that's moved into a management role on the team in the dugout. They've now lost their third base coach, Brett Butler, but he's not really gone. He's now kind of in a different role. And now Lenny Harris is pinch hitting for him as the third baseman, which is a role he's really comfortable with. What do you think of this whole situation in Miami? Is it really just as clown shoes as it appears to be, or do you think there's, you know, something that we might be missing here?
Yeah, so I think it's a really interesting situation, and I think there are two kind of really big red flags about the situation that obviously are going to give you pause. The first being, it happened at, I think, a very strange time in that you're going to get Jose Fernandez back. I think it was Christian Yelich was about to come back, something like that. Like, it seemed too early to give up on, to, like, bail on Mike Redman, who had seemingly, like, I'm not going to say he was, you know, the best manager in the league, had seemingly done a fine job by manager standards for the duration of his tenure there. So it didn't, you know, I don't know what's going on in the clubhouse, but no one seemed to have open problems with Mike Redman. So it was a weird time to fire a manager. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, you never know what's going on there. The other thing is obviously that it's the Marlins and that Jeffrey Loria was, you know, fingerprints all over this. You know, they fire managers there, like they extend them for like 10 years and say, nope, you're gone after 6 weeks. And it's a very impulsive organization. They're very quick to change their sort of direction. And, you know, in one way, I think they're like kind of the opposite of the Astros, and the Astros committed to a plan like 6 years ago or 5 years ago, and they're going to stick with it no matter what anyone thinks. Mm-hmm. And the Marlins will change their plan if they like kind of wake up on the wrong side of the bed.
Sure.
So I think that's what sets up the kind of the ridicule in my mind. However, I am kind of really interested to see how this goes. I think bringing a general manager into the manager's role is a really interesting thing that I wish had happened in a more like non-crazy context, because I think it's the kind of thing I would want to try. Not necessarily in the sense of, I don't think necessarily you need like the best statistician as the manager. I think that's a relatively small part of what the manager does. I think, you know, we look at the Pirates and say, you need Clint Hurdle, who's a baseball guy who was willing to listen to the people upstairs who have some ideas about how you might want to do some things generally. That's a good kind of receptive kind of person for that job. What's really interesting is that we have basically used the same formula to select managers forever until about 2 years ago. And then it was, okay, now we're just going to use former players who just retired, who are young, and we thought they were smart when they were players. They were a special assistant for a year. Now they're the manager. That became the new trend. And then, like, this hyper, like, hockey stick curve of, like, how the manager job is changing. Now, forget it. Let's just cut out the middleman. The GM's going to go downstairs and run the clubhouse. I think that's really interesting because in most other professions, it wouldn't be that strange to try like a different managerial protocol. Mm-hmm. Like if I don't know what your boss is like, but like if my boss's boss came in and took over my division, like it wouldn't be like crazy. Like, it'd be strange because it's a new person, but it's not like, hey, this person has no business being here. Because in most professions, you move up the ladder, and it's sort of like a, you know, it's a Pareto principle thing, and people stall out when they're no longer capable of it. But in baseball, there's like these two separate tracks where baseball people are managers and like business people are GMs, and then it's not the same, except that Dan Jennings was a scout. Like, Dan Jennings comes from the old tradition. He's been gone too long. It's really interesting, the backlash and everything too, of how managers have responded. I'm always open to these like totally reinventions of the position. There is no reason why the manager role should be what it is. It's just tradition. Like, you know, you don't even necessarily need a manager. You just need somebody to tell what the lineup is and to pull the pitchers. You don't need – it doesn't need to be a guy who coaches you. You have coaches for that. It could be a totally different job. Like, the pitching coach and the hitting coach could be autonomous. There's no reason why they have to interact. It's a kind of – I like the idea of shaking up the dugout. I remember – I don't know. It must have been 6 months ago that on Effectively Wild, I think they talked about, like, reinventing the manager position and, like, what would be different, what would look different. And I think this is kind of like one that no one saw coming. And right. That, like, what if like the GM just was the manager, because he's their boss anyway, and he's going to come down because he doesn't like the way that people have been doing it. He's like, I'm going to do it myself. And there's really no reason why that shouldn't work, except for the friction it caused based on the transition.
Yeah, and if a team is going to try it, the Marlins seem like the worst team to try it.
Exactly.
They're a team that has, you know, a meddling owner, considered, you know, to be a meddling owner who interferes in GM decisions, has possibly interfered in some other sorts of decisions that the team's making. They're a team that has no positive will, either, I think, among other teams or even, you know, among their fan base. I mean, you assume that when the Marlins do something, they're doing something for some sort of nefarious motive, like it's just about money, or it's just about Jeffrey Loria feeding his ego in some way or something like that. So you tend to have this assumption with them. I mean, this is not also not the first GM to ever become a manager.
Yes.
It's the first one to go in this kind of weird fashion, but, like, you know, Bobby Cox was the GM of the Braves before, and nobody has a problem with Bobby Cox. And even A.J. Hinch of the Astros, he wasn't the Astros GM, but he was in charge in a front office role and then moved down to the dugout and back and forth. So it's one of those things where it's just such a bizarre situation because it's the Marlins, and now it's like they were already paying Ozzie Guillen for this year. They were already paying Mike Redmond for this year. To me, it almost feels like we hired Dan Jennings for this position because we don't want to pay another guy.
Yeah.
You know, we just are going to put somebody in there who we don't have to cut another paycheck for, and then once eventually this works out. It doesn't seem like it was done by design. It seems like it was done exactly like you said, because Jeffrey Loria woke up and he called Michael Hill and David Sampson and they said, hey, we need to hire a manager. Your budget is zero. Give me your best idea. And they said, well, you know, Dan was a scout. Let's let Dan do it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the concern, is that this wasn't a plan. It wasn't like they sat down and they strategically planned, what's our organization's direction going to be for the next 5 or 10 years? What if we tried this? Like, if the Astros did this, if the Cubs did this, if Oakland did this, if a team did this, like, as part of a plan, it would be, I think, a really cool thing. I would be really excited about it. Here, it's more like, we got upset with the manager. Jeffrey Loria had some problem with Mike Redmond. I don't know what it was. And he said, okay, you know what? I like Dan Jennings. I'm going to put Dan Jennings in charge. It's very much it very much felt like a Steinbrenner kind of thing, where he would just yell, you know, call down to the manager and tell him to bat Reggie Jackson fourth or whatever. And the manager wouldn't do it. So instead of, you know, firing Billy Martin and hiring someone else, he's like, I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah.
And so that's the part that's kind of, you don't like. But I think it's really fascinating. I would love to see it work moderately well, just to get a different kind of mood into the manager role. Because really what everyone says, and I think, you know, people who are right about this, say most of the manager's job is, you know, sort of managing the personalities on the club, making sure people feel like they know their role and are, you know, supported, and that the manager has their back with the media and with the front office, like all of these kind of interpersonal leadership kind of things. Like, that's really their job. We complain about the strategy a lot, you know, and that's fine. Anybody can presumably learn the strategy if they're open to it. But there's no reason why the person has to be a former player. There's no reason why you couldn't put someone who's a good manager, who has some baseball knowledge, in charge of a team and have them perform well. And so I like that this is sort of like the first guy through the wall, just to kind of open the door to that option, so that we're getting a little bit of a different perspective in the manager's chair. Because I think the old player who is either managing the minors or not managing the minors now, it's kind of a stale position, and there's very little innovation going on in that position, and there's so much innovation going on everywhere else in the game that I think it's good for the sport.
Well, so then we got to ask the big question then. Gun to your head, who do you rather have managing the Tigers, Brad Ausmus or Dave Dombrowski?
Yeah, so that I thought about this a lot this week. I think Dombrowski would do just as fine a job. Like, I don't think there's anything Ausmus brings to the table that Dombrowski couldn't do if that's what he put his attention on. He is clearly, like, the players really seem to like Dombrowski. Guys come, you know, to the organization, they feel comfortable with him. He is clearly a player's GM, and that he doesn't mind signing, you know, stars for money and stuff like that. He has never, at least as the Tigers GM, he has never gone to arbitration with a player. Like, mm-hmm. that, there's something very, I think, that the players really like about that. Not just that, he didn't go to arbitration with me, he gave me what I deserved. The players recognize that the Tigers don't, you know, penny pinch when it comes to the guys who are in the organization. Like, maybe they won't sign a reliever they should sign for an extra $1 million, but if you wear the old English D, you get kind of what you should get. I think that's important. Dombrowski is no less, you know, traditionalistic in his methodology than Ausmus is, you know, in the dugout. He clearly is open to the right ideas. He's a smart guy. I think he could actually do a fine job, and I would actually really like to see it. Like, there's a 0% probability it would happen. Mm-hmm. But I think it would be fine. And that's what kind of what made me open to the idea of Dan Jennings, is that, like, I can't think of a reason why I trust Ausmus as the manager more than Dombrowski. Clearly, Ausmus is a better teacher of certain parts of baseball skills, but that's not the manager's job so much. You know, I would never hire a GM to be the pitching coach or the hitting coach or the bullpen coach. You know, Ausmus is definitely better at helping James McCann learn to manage a pitching staff than Dave Dombrowski. But setting a lineup, switching pitchers, you know, making sure that everybody feels comfortable, I could see Dombrowski doing that just fine.
All right, done. We'll let management know. We'll inform the Tigers of the changes to take place immediately.
Right.
And we'll see how that goes. Neil, thanks so much for being on the show. I really appreciate having you on. We'll go ahead and we'll call it.
All right.
Now that all the big decisions have been made and we move forward, I'll let you know that there's a couple of ways to contact the podcast. You can find us on Twitter. We're Shift Podcast on Twitter. ShiftPodcast@gmail.com if you have any comments, questions, want to get in touch with the show. And then you can also always find our episodes of the show on BeyondTheBoxScore.com, where you can find all sorts of great writing, lots of great new writers at the site recently. So go by and check out the site. Thanks for listening, and we'll be doing another show soon.